Welcome back to Search and Rescue Pentagon Escape. Today we going to read Mikey at 9:52 a.m. Listen what they say.
Mikey, 9:52 a.m. AE drive is chaos. I glance toward the hole I just came through and see a blown out window on the second floor, just as someone jumps from it into the arms of the huge officer below. I can hear the thump of impact as the man catches the jumper and they both hit the ground, winded but alive. Or, at least, I think alive. I can't tell if the person who jumped from the window is a man or woman, black or white, old or young, civilian or military. Anything. They look like charcoal in human form, blackened and burned all over, and the man on whom they landed is immediately rolling them around, patting the flames out. Before I can see anything else, more people have scooped the burned person up onto a stretcher made out of what used to be a door, and are carrying them away in a hurry. I get my bearings and see that people are everywhere now are still climbing. Lena and I hadn't come through that huge hole in the first floor wall alone after all. People letting out behind where we were, though I hadn't seen or heard any of them inside. Maybe they couldn't talk, or maybe I'd just been so focused on my own situation, I hadn't noticed anyone else's. I've heard that, in a crisis, it can be dangerous to get what they call tunnel vision, where you only see a narrow point directly in front of you and can't glimpse the bigger picture. I thought I'd been so clear-headed in there, but now I know I hadn't seen anything clearly. There are so many more people who need help and also more people helping. A whole line of soldiers, sailors, marines, and civilians has formed at the top of the rubble heap, and they're pulling people out and passing them down to volunteers on the ground. I shiver, feeling suddenly cold. I just climbed that way, I think. Did I climb over all those people without even seeing them? I notice to my left what looks like part of a huge truck tire, which takes me a second to recognize as a piece of landing gear from a jet. I'm still staring at it, puzzling it out, when I notice that someone is talking to me. Someone has been talking to me. Kid. She says. Are you hurt? Are you breathing okay? On it, so I it's a woman with her hair in a tight ponytail. She's in a khaki shirt with ribbons and insignia thinks she's a Navy officer. But I don't really know. She's taller than I am, and she bends down to look me in the eyes. Her eyes are kind but worried. Who are you here with? Are you in a school group? Where is your escort? She taps the plastic badge around my neck. I'd forgotten I was wearing it. When I look down, I'm shocked to see the plastic is bent and melted. Suddenly, I notice the pain in my neck from where the little metal necklace that held it had been digging into me all this time. Maybe even burning me. My escort, I say, my thoughts jumbled. I'm supposed to be with my escort. Sergeant Ginsler or my dad. But I'm alone. I'm unauthorized to be alone here, and I worry that she's going to think I'm involved, that I set off the bomb or something. Except I'm still looking at the huge piece of landing gear and I know it wasn't a bomb that went off. It was a plane crash. A plane crashed into the Pentagon and tore through the three outer rings all the way here, to AE Drive, and I'm standing here without my escorts because I left them inside. My dad. I suddenly say. And Sergeant Ginsler. He's alive. He's right in there. I've snapped back to my senses and I start to move toward the rubble pile to get back inside to help them. The officer grabs me, pulls me back. You can't go in there, she says. You need to evacuate to the parking lot. They'll, she gets cut off by a shout for help from the rubble pile. A group of men are digging on the heap right where I'd climbed down, and they've uncovered an arm. I gag and cough again, thinking of the horror I'm about to see, but the arm is attached to a body, a man in a suit, who they're digging out of the heap. His head is slumped over and his face is bloody, but he seems to be alive. My stomach unknots. Warmth floods me. It's Dad. I start toward him, but then he lifts his head. He's not my father, just another guy in a suit. So I stay put as the officer runs over, identifying herself as a medic. She shines a tiny penlight into the man's eyes, working with the rescuers to get him out of the rubble. She's already forgotten me because I'm not critically injured. I guess in a crisis like this, a kid all alone isn't as much of a priority if he isn't, like, I'm directly in danger of dying. At least no one thinks I'm part of an attack. At another hole in the wall near the big one I'd scrambled from, a group of men are going back inside. One or two of them have painter's masks on. Others have wrapped wet cloth around their faces. I can tell by the soot on some of their clothes that they've been inside already. They know what they're doing, and most have military haircuts. These are the sort of guys who run into danger to help people. Maybe they can help Sergeant Gensler. Maybe they can find my dad. I know where there's a survivor, I say, running over to them. At least he was alive a few minutes ago. A man in an Air Force uniform looks me up and down quickly, and I see his rank is Lieutenant General. He's also got a medical symbol on his uniform. A general who's also a doctor. He's just what I need right now. Sir, I say, because I know that officers, unlike enlisted Marines, like to be called sir. There's an injured Marine I had to leave behind. He was somewhere in the Navy command center in all the cubicles. I think he's hurt. His name is Sergeant Gensler. If you're going in, he needs help. The Lieutenant General nods at me and then passes the info to the guy waiting to go inside. One soldier comes out, coughing and carrying an injured woman on his back, passing her down to the next person in line. The third person moves forward with a flashlight and his shirt over his nose and mouth. He scurries in, beneath the thick smoke. After what feels like forever, but is probably only about 3 minutes, he comes out again. His face is black with grime that's cut by sweat lines, so he looks like a horror movie zebra human experiment gone wrong. He looks at the Lieutenant General and shakes his head. Can't get any farther in. Can't even see. Rescuers are starting to move away from the holes in the walls. There are no more people crawling out, and going back in through these holes doesn't seem like an option. There's rubble everywhere on AE Drive, but I know there are doors into Corridor 4 and Corridor 5. Maybe we can get in that way. My dad's office was right near the Corridor 5 exit, so if he got out, he might still be there. And maybe someone can go in to look for Sergeant Gensler too. I run in that direction, dodging people on the ground who are trying to catch their breath, people crying, people just staring, people rushing about to help other people. I dodge debris and equipment and I nearly fall flat on my face, tripping over a blown open suitcase with Toy Story 2 on it, and I think, why would someone in the Department of Defense have a Toy Story 2 suitcase? Then I remember the plane. This must have been on the plane that crashed into the building. A kid's suitcase. Right then, I want to throw up. I fall to my knees, which hurts, and my imagination starts to run away from me again. I used to have a Power Rangers suitcase the same size as this one. I took it on the flight to live with my dad. I wonder where the kid on this flight was going. I'm about to start sobbing, but the sight of firefighters coming down AE Drive brings my focus back to the present. I take as deep a breath as I can, though the air smells foul. I can't focus on the tragedy that's happened. I have to focus on the work ahead and on all the people trying to help. I have a choice to make, to be a victim or a helper right now, and I know what I want to be. I make my way toward the firefighters, but just then I see someone familiar. It's the skinny guy from my dad's office. He's standing right in front of me, but it's not clear if he even sees me. He's got a faraway look in his eyes, and he's pretty banged up. Torn clothes, a cut on his arm, and he's not putting any weight on one of his legs. Half his face is covered in soot and he's not wearing his glasses anymore. Sir? Mister? Guy? I call to him. I don't know his name and I can't read his uniform. He stares at me like he's not sure I'm really there. We met before. I'm Dave Cutler's son, Mike? Mikey? Mikey? He says absently, like he's not quite sure. He probably can't see me well without his glasses. His eyes aren't really focused and I see that his pupils are huge. Have you seen my dad? I ask. He was there. He was in the meeting. I was outside the room. I was just typing. The building shook and then. He shakes his head, looks toward the holes in the side of the wall. Did he get out? I plead. Is he alive? The guy nods. Alive, yeah. I lost him though. I think he's. He's not out. I don't think. I don't know if. His voice fades. He looks pale, like a super unhealthy pale, and I think about the first aid course I took back in Utah. My mom had insisted I learn CPR. I thought she was just being responsible, but I came to learn she wanted me to know what to do if she overdosed, or had an accident or a heart attack while she was on drugs. I was the only person in her life she could count on, so she wanted me to know what to do if her life was in danger. The thing is, her life was in danger. Every time she used, her life was a little more in danger, and so was mine. And no first aid course I took could help her. They didn't teach how to save your mom from herself at the YMCA. I think back to the CPR class. The first thing they teach are the ABCs. You check airway, breathing, then circulation, like if someone's bleeding. If that's all okay, then you can start to assess the other problems. Are there burns that need treatment? Probably, but I can't do anything about that. Broken bones that need setting? Also probably, but I'm no help there either. Maybe a concussion, maybe muscle or spine injuries, but I can't tell. What I do recognize now though are the symptoms of shock. This young soldier from my dad's office is going into shock. His injuries must be worse than they look. His breathing accelerates and I worry he's hyperventilating, like he's gonna pass out. I move forward and take his hand, and I guide him down first to my level and then until he's lying down on the ground. There's some rubble right near us and I turn him a little. He doesn't weigh much and he doesn't resist at all, so that his feet are elevated. That's one of the first things you should do for someone in shock. If you can safely move them, get their feet up. That helps the blood flow to their important organs so they don't start shutting down. You don't have to be a military medic to know that someone's organs shutting down is not a good thing. Help. I call out. He's going into shock. The lieutenant general is there in a flash. I get the sense he'd been keeping an eye on me, even as he was working to save other people. It's nice to know someone here cares if I'm okay, except now his attention soldier on the ground. He starts tend is on the young into the guy and another soldier comes over to help. They're totally occupied and this guy is getting real, professional, adult help, so I step away. I find the firefighters again, just down the way, near the door to corridor 5. They're trying to wrangle a hose from one of the hookups on the drive to spray a fire on the second floor, but it's burning so hot the water just turns to steam on contact. I jog up to the first firefighter I can find who isn't engaged with the hose work. He's got a mask and breathing tank on, and an axe in his hand, but he's not moving into the building yet. He's looking around, wide-eyed, focused, and assessing the situation but also kind of shocked by what he's seeing. I'm okay, I tell him as his eyes land on me. He flinches. I must look kind of frightful myself. I don't want him immediately assessing me for injuries or shock or anything. I don't have time for that. I'm trying to help people to help my dad and Sergeant Ginsler. If the fire's really as hot as it looks, then we don't have much time. There are survivors still inside. I tell him, shouting in case he can't hear well through his mask. There's a Marine sergeant stuck in the Navy command center. Also, I'm looking for my dad, Dave Cutler. He's a civilian in the. I hesitate. Am I allowed to say he works for the Defense Intelligence Agency? Should I be revealing top secret info to a firefighter? Crisis rules, I tell myself. The old rules don't apply anymore. Maybe they'll never apply again. He's in the DIA offices near Corridor 5 right up that way. We have to find him. He's the only person I have left in the world and I whoa, kid, you gotta slow down, the firefighter says. He grabs my shoulders, looks me up and down, checking me for injuries like I thought he would. He points away from the burning holes. I need you to follow the road that way and get out to the parking lot. His radio buzzes with noise as every firefighter and rescuer with a radio tries to talk at the same time. He's ignoring it, but both of us hear the next words, a voice cutting through the clutter, yelling in a very unfirefighter why way, "We've got another plane incoming." The voice barks. All units evacuate. 20 minutes out. The chorus of static starts up again, but we've heard enough. You gotta go now. Yells the firefighter, and then he and his crew spread the word and hustle away the guys at the edge of the rubble pile who are still looking for ways into the building. I look up at the sky, my stomach in my throat. I brace myself. Another plane incoming? If we're still under attack, it's not like I can run anywhere fast enough. If there's another plane incoming, no one is safe, not here on AE Drive, not in the undamaged parts of the building, and not in the parking lot. When the sky is falling, it's not like you can cover your head and hide under a desk. When the sky is falling, the best thing you can do is be with the people you care about. Now that no one's watching me again, I move toward the Corridor 5 door. I snag a flashlight one of the rescuers left nearby as he went to help someone else. I glance around the drive and back up at the blue sky, now hazy with smoke. They said 20 minutes. Maybe that's enough time for all of us. I hope this isn't the last time I see this sky, but if I'm gonna die today, I'm gonna die trying to save my dad.